Saving Throw. I'm Scott, and we are on the scene at Fan Expo 2011, and we are talking to Malcolm Shepard. No, not TV's Malcolm Shepard, but the White Wolf Gaming and various other projects, Malcolm Shepard, who, because he's talking to me, is much cooler. And what are your thoughts on the con so far?
Well, I just got here. It's busy. And it's going to get busier. It's quite a big convention. I'm really happy with the size of the gaming this year, and I'm looking forward to playing a few things. Instead of doing formal panels, this year we're just going to sort of be having free discussions. We're going to grab people, give them about an hour's notice, and talk about whatever takes our or their fancy.
For those of you who might not be so familiar, maybe give a few writing credits, mention some things you might have worked on that they know, and
okay. Well, I've been freelancing for about 10 years, actually a little over 10 years now, and I've also done some self-publishing things. And I guess people would know me from freelancing for Mage of the Ascension, Mage of the Awakening, for Exalted, for the Dark Ages line, a bunch of those White Wolf lines. I also developed a game called Eternal Legends, and that's a game that was created by Stu Wilson, and we sort of worked together on the rules, but the setting and the particular evolution of that stuff was entirely his. It's a modern fantasy game, and I hope people check it out, but I'm not going to push it any more than that. And, oh yeah, what else? I guess I've done some stuff for Cyberpunk, for Eclipse Phase, and, you know, there are a couple of other creative buns in the oven, so that's all I can think of right now.
You say you've been freelancing for 10 years now. Do you have any thoughts on the whole experience of working in that? Any advice for people who want to get into that at all?
I guess one of the big things in game freelancing is that there is a deceptively low threshold for entry, right? So, you know, pretty much anybody can pick up a job working on something for a penny a word, right? What I would really like people to do is really start thinking in terms of the distinctions that are used in fiction writing, say in science fiction and horror, where we have the amateur, semi-pro, and pro tiers. And, you know, even if we don't use those tiers in RPGs, there should still be that thinking in terms of your commitment and in terms of the kind of relationship you're going to have, right? Something where you're going to take a penny a word and do it for fun and see what happens is a different sort of experience than working on a large intellectual property, right? And those things are different than, say, designing your own game, which is something else that happens at different scales. Yeah. So if people sort of regulate their expectations accordingly, and also just, you know, utilize good writing craft too, you know, especially with self-publishing, try not to rush that stuff out too much. And it's easy to get caught up in the play and procedure aspects of it and not communicate things very well. And that is something I have to say has been improving, but occasionally you see some real clunkers.
Mm-hmm. All right, so any particular experiences or thoughts on working with White Wolf that you want to share with anyone? Like just fun aspects of the setting and the system, good things that you enjoy or things you enjoy about working for them?
Well, you know, I've given them a lot of my words, so I guess I have to order my thoughts into important ones. I suppose one of the big things is that this may be boring to some people, but with White Wolf, they've always had a very good workflow, right? And by that I mean sort of the way responsibilities go from one person to the next, right? And it's always been good to work with say someone like Bill Bridges or Ethan Skemp, who have an attitude that's very sort of trusting of the freelancers who are working on these games and intellectual properties, right? Yeah. Who outline it, but very generally and allow you a great deal of freedom. I've also recently worked with Matt McFarland, and they're all great for that. And there's a sense of back and forth where they give you the outline, you do your work on it, and, you know, sometimes maybe you stretch the bounds of the outline a bit. And, you know, then they sort of bring it back. And through that dialogue, you have a vision. I've really learned to respect that process, and I wish it was something that was applied more widely. I've found sometimes that, you get a situation where, you know, the outline keeps changing and the objectives keep changing, and there's no sense of the order of whose turn it is to do something, right? And then nothing gets done, or there are big gaps in it. And it's easy not only to do that in a multi-person operation, but also internally. You know, someone once told me that whenever you go back to fix things, if you get to the point where you keep going back to make corrections, well, that's writer's block. Like, that's what it is, right? It's not this mystical state of looking at the paper and having nothing, although that sometimes happens, right? It's where you get into this loop where you don't have a way to order your thoughts to the task at hand. So White Wolf has been very good for imposing that. I found it interesting to see how the games sort of match the political climate of the times, right?
Yeah.
For example, right, there's a lot of things in White Wolf games that, well, you know, they don't exactly fly now, right? The association with, you know, supernatural splats and real-world ethnicities, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's something that's kind of embarrassing, but in retrospect, this was coming up in the 1990s where, you know, there was the mainstreaming of the idea of going beyond equality through the melting pot and getting into the idea of, you know, of identity as something that's, you know, that's precious, and preservation of identity being a social justice issue, right? And that's something that's reflected in the games, in the thing of the time. Of course, it's applied, you know, it's applied very back and forth at times, right? And then, you know, when I got in, that was sort of after the, you know, it was in the mid-late 90s. So, you know, I was with Revised Mage. So, you know, with that and with people working in Werewolf and Vampire, they're going back to those properties and seeing these, you know, wild, unrefined ideas that were based on these, you know, political developments in the 1990s. And then, you know, trying to sort of, I don't want to say improve them, because every designer, every writer has their reasons for doing things the way they do. But certainly to add a level of another, well, it's sort of you make a change that's in it, that's a dialogue with the text that comes before you, right? Like, I wrote a bunch of Mage Tradition books, right?
Yeah.
And they were Revised Tradition books. So, you know, they exist in this dialogue with the books that came before them, right? Sometimes, you know, I didn't like what came in the previous book. So, you know, there might be something that refutes it. Or sometimes it extends it or questions it or complicates it. So you have all those things coming up. And that's a process that I think is gone for good or ill. If there's something I would want to be different about my experience with White Wolf, it would probably be sort of the continuity of creative influence. And that sometimes you have a big turnover in staff or a shift in ideas, and I think sometimes you don't always see what the essence of what came before was, right? There's just a hazy idea. Now, you have the developers, and some of them have been around for quite some time, like Bill Bridges, who kind of act as the gatekeepers of that. But if it's not in sort of the, you know, down and dirty creative staff as well, I think you sometimes lose something. And it sometimes looks like you're constantly betraying the fans by going, well, you know, this book that you read earlier, well, it sucks, right? Like, it sounds like you're trying to shill them a revision or a new book or something like, or you're just insulting what came before, right? Where instead it's because you don't have direct access to what, you know, what people were thinking before, right? Like, I didn't have direct access to, you know, working on Mage Revised, didn't have direct access to Phil Ricardo's thoughts when he was working on Mage second edition, right?
Right.
So, you know, sometimes maybe my work looked like I was going like, you know, hey, Phil, go screw yourself, right? But I, you know, I have a great deal of respect for Phil Ricardo, and that wouldn't be my intention at all. So, you know, you have that jarring thing, and I think the companies that have long-term properties really have to, you know, understand their roots and their full continuity. Otherwise, you end up with these jarring moments. You end up offending the fans, too, right? I mean, there's that whole thing where, what was that? Neverwinter? The Neverwinter supplement for 4th edition?
Yeah.
And they were, and the press kit said it was the first city supplement for Dungeons & Dragons. And that, you know, that pissed a lot of people off,
yeah,
right? And that's sort of a really crude example of what I'm talking about. I guess that was a long answer to your question.
Eh,
so
that's fine.
You're just continuing the tradition of my White Wolf interviews being on the talky side. No one seems to mind. Okay, obviously you've had a good relationship with White Wolf, but I just wanted to get a gauge of your personal preferences. It's like, do you prefer new versus old, and which game line do you think you like the best?
I like Mage of the Ascension. I think it's one of the most important mainstream role-playing games ever released. Period. I've worked on both Mage of the Ascension and Mage of the Awakening, and they're very different games. I think, I wish Mage of the Awakening would get another edition just to solidify some of the ideas that came up, right? I mean, we were trying to really get it right the first time. And certainly as a playable game, as something that, gives you lots of inspirations and gives you procedures for play, it works well. But as an inspiring text where you read it from start to finish and go, oh man, I want to do that, it's choppy in spots, right?
Yeah, there's if you haven't read New Mage, you get a lot of cool ideas and then no clue where to go with them. And because of New World of Darkness's five books rule, it didn't get developed as much, just to clarify. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the idea is that you have the three, with the New World of Darkness, right, you have the three core books that are continuously supported, right?
Yeah.
And then you have a new fourth game, right, periodically. Now, that's changed, it's, I think, 7 years since the New World of Darkness core and
yeah.
Vampire the Requiem. So, so a lot of things have changed, but I think part of it is that, certainly White Wolf isn't doing the thing where, they throw together the first edition, right? Mm-hmm. Like they did for the classic World of Darkness stuff. And they toss that out and it's, full of all kinds of craziness. And then they sort of refine a little bit in the second, right? Yeah. There was an attempt to just, to use everything that had been learned and there was a very, got to get it right the first time. And the thing is, I think in, hindsight is 20/20. You can't get it right the first time. Right? You can do a good job, but when you have a game that is a, ongoing interest that you're developing, then, you're always going to find new stuff, right? I mean, the original Mage of the Awakening was very much sort of a, it's this Gnostic sorcery RPG that's steeped in sort of the, Western ceremonial magic tradition, right? Because it's something that Bill Bridges in particular, has a very deep knowledge of, right, and specific ideas on how to make gameable, right? But of course, as you play with that, you're going, you start with a game being a little more than the sum total of its inspirations. But then as, you come up with books and ideas and things and you get feedback from play, it starts to develop a more robust identity of its own, right? And I think Mage of the Awakening could probably use another, it could use either another edition or a very big companion book that sort of sets itself out. And the New World of Darkness, I think, generally has a problem compared to the classic World of Darkness in not setting out the same kind of strident thesis about what it's about. With Mage of the Ascension, right, you have this big thing where, you're playing members of these sort of subaltern cultures who are essentially fighting against, fighting against sort of Western-centric imperialism, right? I mean, that's what it's about. I mean, it's couched in technology and the idea that, that there are many levels in which this is engaged, right? In that you have the idea of technology as a gift, but you have also have the idea of technology as a locus for control. And you have all these complexities, but there's a big zesty conflict there. And it's something that's accessible and something that's relevant to our experience, right? I mean, that's why people like to argue about Mage the Ascension so much, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's because, you have the main villains use the, same methods and rationales for social control that, real governments and real think tanks use, right? There's the same fear of extremism in your protagonists and the traditions as there is in, any sort of non-modernist, non-Western hegemonic subculture, right? So, that's big and that matters to people. Even if they're not going to use big words to talk about it the way I am,
yeah.
even if they're having it as a feeling, it's there. And, you know, with Werewolf, you have the same kind of, you know, you have these big conflicts that really, you know, they churn your heart. With A New World of Darkness, I think Vampire the Requiem was able to bring that theme forward to the exhibition the most, probably because there was the least amount of difference between the two games, and because you have the, you know, you have the humanity system, which is a genius thing that was carried from game to game and is really one of the, you know, it's something that really is a major step forward in, well, not a major step forward. There are lots of morality and sanity and systems like that, but there's something special about that system. Mm-hmm. But when you get to the other games, I think they're a lot more gamerly, in which means that there's a lot more room for you to develop your own stuff. And they kind of, there's an idea that we want to move out of the way of encouraging any moral stance about the protagonists, and we want to keep there from being an overarching plot or the possibility of these big NPCs. But, you know, and that's something that makes it very on-the-ground gameable, right? And so does the idea of, you know, all the games sort of encourage you to have these, you know, local kind of social matrix play games where, you know, it's your town by night, or your town with fur and rocks, or whatever it is for Werewolf. I like Werewolf, but I have trouble imagining that kind of campaign for Forsaken personally, although I know people who played it. And, you know, and it makes it very good as a toolkit, but perhaps it doesn't have that zesty heart-churning thing that the classic World of Darkness has, right? And of course you always have the problem with, you know, you have games that are inspired by older games. There's always going to be that comparison there, and the younger game is almost always not going to fare as well, whether it's, you know, whether it's just to make that comparison or not.
And with White Wolf revisiting some of its roots with Vampire 20th Anniversary Edition, do you hope you might see this happen down the line for Werewolf or Mage or even bring back Wraith?
Well, they did announce at Gen Con that there was going to be a new edition of Werewolf the Apocalypse. There was going to be a 20th anniversary Werewolf of the Apocalypse. They've announced this thing called the Onyx Path, where they're going to create new supplements for the classic games. I think there's a new supplement for Vampire the Masquerade coming. They're also going to finish the convention books from Age of the Ascension, the Technocracy splat books, right, which they only ever got one out for Revised. So now they're going to do the rest. So, I mean, they're certainly giving the love to the classic World of Darkness again. But they're supporting the new World of Darkness, too. So, like, I just finished work on a high-level magic book for Mage of the Awakening, right? Imperial Mysteries. I just sent my draft in for that, and it was announced, right? So there's going to be support for Mage of the Awakening and for the other old World of Darkness games. I can't speak for, you know, what the plans are at White Wolf specifically, because I'm just a freelancer for them, right? But I think they're listening to what fans have to say quite a lot about what they want. And I think there's certainly an emphasis on looking at the virtues of each and working with those. I'm not sure what else to say in terms of bringing back. Well, I would love it if they did a 20th anniversary version of Mage of the Ascension, and I would certainly love to work on anything to do with that, but I have no idea if that's ever going to happen. As for Wraith, oh, I don't even know. Wraith is such a beautiful game. It's so problematic in spots, too. I think maybe it's one of those games that that the culture of RPG players is maybe a little more ready for now, but it's also one where I think some of the procedures need to be revisited for how to play Shadow and work with that aspect of the game. I think there's been a lot of work done in the past 10 years about systematizing those sorts of weird relationships, right? About how do you play your character's eternal life, right? That certainly can be drawn on to make that easier. If they can do that without sort of adulterating Wraith's essence, I think that would be fantastic. But I certainly have no inside information about that.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, I love Wraith, and I certainly hope some love is given to it at some point, even though it's, you know, it's certainly one of their problem children.
Yeah.
All right. So you've also done some work. You did some work on gate crashing for Eclipse Phase. Do you want to talk about what you did and that experience and how and any other thoughts on Eclipse Phase as a whole?
Well, the funny thing with Eclipse Phase is that I'm actually a transhumanist skeptic myself, right? I'm not, I don't believe in the rapture of the nerds, right? I don't think we're going to get uploaded into computers and be really cool all the time. But I'm really interested in the ideas, and I'm really interested in the notion of identity. However, that's not what gay crashing was about. I did sort of knock around ideas with the writing and development team when the core book was being made, and that's what I like to talk about. But for gay crashing, I worked on a couple of different worlds, and some of them got in and some of them didn't, right? I guess the one that I can think of offhand that got into the book was the anonymous communications network where you talk to aliens.
Yeah.
And I guess part of it was that I wanted to have something that avoided, well, the way Eclipse Phase works, right, is you have a lot of worlds where aliens were and they're gone, right? And I wanted to have at least some idea that there was an alien, still an alien presence out there, but leave it indeterminate so that, first of all, it's gameable, and second of all, I don't throw this big new fact into the setting, right?
Right.
And certainly, you have to keep the integrity of the setting in mind, right? So, so that was sort of the X factor that I wanted by having it anonymous. And plus, it leads to a lot of, I wasn't even thinking, chat roulette. Yeah, some people called it alien chat roulette. And I was not thinking of that, but I guess.
Best no one thinks of chat roulette.
This is true. So yeah, that's what I did. I think the work I've done on Eclipse Phase the most is the stuff I didn't get paid for. Well, I mean, it wasn't really work. It was just playing around with ideas, right? For example, there's a big discussion about hacking your own brain, right? Because one of the things is that once you can reprogram your mind and once you can forking yourself is not what you might think. It's creating a duplicate of your personality that can run around and do its own thing. Well, where do you go with traditional adventuring goals, right? If, like, it's hard to have a horror game if you have the unlimited ability to fix your brain so you're not afraid and don't get mentally ill anymore, or restore yourself from a sane backup, right?
Right.
Or have a contingent program that creates several duplicates of yourself to go and see what happened to you, right? So all those are big challenges. And I think Eclipse Phase, it adds a few necessary limits, but they're reasonable within the bounds of the genre. They took up a big challenge with that, and especially in the system and in the expression of the setting. So I felt I'm glad to have that credit in the core book, even if it was just for talking a lot of crap in the background. So.
See, that's something that should be a job title.
Oh, sorry.
Director of talking about crap.
Director of talking about crap. Well, that's, I think probably that's what happens in sort of centralized development. I've never done any group development or anything like that, right? I've never done a development kit for White Wolf, for example. But I imagine that they sit around and talk about crap.
Yeah.
I hope so. I mean, certainly, the outlines look pretty good. They don't look like crap. You get all the crap out. I have no more usage for the word crap now. So what?
we're out of craps.
We're out of crap.
I have to double check with my editor if I'm allowed to say crap. We'll see. You mentioned your work on an indie project whose name is now slipping my mind. And just tell us a bit about that and maybe where they can get it.
Okay. Eternal Legends, which is Eternal with an A and an E, is a modern fantasy game that was originally conceived by Stu Wilson. Well, basically, here's the thing. I had this little house system that I used to run one-shots, and I was running a cyberpunk genre game, and I started to share it with my friends, right? And just, nothing, no aspirations to sell this, right? And then... And then Stu Wilson, who I knew through freelancing for White Wolf, he's done a whole bunch of work for Werewolf in particular that's just smashing. And he gave me this, he he sent this like 2-page, you know, quick game outline, and he called it sort of like a twee fantasy game where love conquers all, and you know, and you can be heroic. And you know, I was getting more and more interested in actually doing something with this system, because as I gave it to my friends, right, they were using it for different things and telling me they were being very successful with it. So I looked back and I saw Stu's outline and I asked him if he was interested in turning it into a full-blown game, and he said yes. So we began work on it. And the idea is, it's sort of a modern fantasy game that takes a lot, you know. We basically didn't want to lend too much power to plausibility, right?
Yeah.
In this game, right, you have it's a hidden world fantasy game, right? A lot like the World of Darkness games, except that, you know, in this we, you know, say that, you know, one person in 20 knows magic is there, right? And yeah, okay, it wouldn't, you know, it would never pass muster in the real world, but it's necessary for us to have these big fantasy landscapes and fantasy civilizations and fantasy nations in the background. So we just have a little paragraph saying, like, really, just let it pass, right?
Yeah.
In the same way that you know, you let the idea that there's a ministry of magic and large Quidditch arenas in the world in Harry Potter, you don't squint too hard at that, and you just have some fun with it. So we wanted to do that. We also wanted to, we both done work for World of Darkness stuff where, you know, everything is terrible, and there are monsters who are going to rip your head off.
And you can't get a date.
And you can't get a date, except with one of those monsters.
Doesn't understand you.
Yes. because your head's been ripped off, and you can no longer speak. So, anyway, but we wanted to go with the idea that, you know, you're playing traditional high fantasy heroes, and you're going on these big Tolkien-esque quests. And that's okay. We wanted to totally get behind all that hero's journey stuff that, you know, in all these other books we don't do. Yeah, we don't do, right? So, you know, in the game you have the world as we know it, and you have the supernatural world. And the supernatural world is concealed from normal people who are unaware, right? And you have normal places, and you also have secret places, right? You know, you have the platform 9.5s, right?
Yeah.
And you have the secret kingdoms, right? And you have the underground chambers, and you have the, you know, you have gangs of pirates on stolen subway cars, right? And you have people who are secretly elves and orcs and gnomes, right? And people who can, you know, bind a fire elemental to your toaster, because it makes it a better toaster, right? And you have all this stuff happening in the background, and people going on tremendous quests and things like that, but with all of the urban stuff around them, right? So we can have the subway pirates, right? So,
and orcs with miniguns.
Yeah. And I guess, yeah, and you can have orcs with miniguns. So then, sort of, you know, there's that initial sort of enthusiasm and, like, you know, screw it, we're doing the full urban fantasy thing. And then we sort of went back to, well, how do you really make that be something that resonates beyond just being the expected hero's journey, right?
Right.
And the idea is that we wanted to make the hero's journey something like the spiritual quest that your character is going through, right? And that the world sort of determines itself to oppose you, and it's something that sort of merges with these hermetic Kabbalistic ideas about the nature of the world and the nature of the magician's journey,
right?
And the idea is that you know eventually, if you're a hero for long enough, you know, there's going to be a dark lord who comes and opposes you, and he's not only just there because he's a dark lord and he's a jerk, right? He's there because your power as a hero demands there to be a figure like this, right?
As part of
your character's spiritual journey. And so combining those two elements made for a very nifty little game, right? It has sort of the traditional fantasy framework. You know, we have our elves and dwarves and gnomes and normal humans. We tried to make sure that Homo sapiensy humans had a specific role too, and weren't just the guys who get an extra skill point. Right.
But I like my extra skill point. I put it in basket weaving.
Yeah, yes. In terms of the system, it's sort of the house system that I designed, that Stu refined and added the setting specific systems to, its main thing is I always found the big barrier to getting a game started was making characters, right? Yeah. Because you have the session where you make characters. Well, have you finished making? Okay, well, next time we'll make more. And then, you know, 5 sessions later, maybe met in a tavern.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, and it's a load on the GM's time, too, right? Because as much, you know, it also takes time for the GM to make NPCs, right? And that time is comparable to the PC making time. So you meet in a tavern. You meet the wizard next week after I create the wizard.
Yeah.
Right? And look at the most optimal wizard build. So we didn't want any of that crap. So I made this system where the objective is to have a character up and running in about 5 minutes.
Right.
But at the same time, I wanted to have... I like high-action games myself.
Right? Yeah.
So I wanted to have a sort of tactical resource where you spend points and you have multiple actions. And you can focus on certain things at the expense of others. So
and all the good fiddly bits.
And all the good fiddly bits. I do like the good fiddly bits. So the idea is that you have... relatively simple characters, but they can plug into fairly sophisticated tactical choices, and we can have good action scenes working off of that, right? So that's the way the system works. The one thing I think throws people off is it's a dice pool system where you roll d6s, and you count the ones and twos only, and you add them. So it really works.
Well, they're easy to spot.
The thing is, right, you know what? I was running it with one group, and they said, oh, this doesn't make sense to us. So I said, okay, how about this way? If you get a 5, you get 1 success. And if you get a 6, you get 2 successes. I said, yeah, that works a lot better. Yeah, it works exactly the same as counting 1s and 2s.
Change the numbers we count.
But high dice are good, and low dice are bad. So, the high but no higher thing has been a psychological barrier, right? But trust me, once you get used to it, it's pretty good.
Any project you've worked on that's sort of a favorite for you, and anything that you sort of wish you'd had a chance to work on?
Any project that's a favorite of mine? I don't know, because some of them, when I worked on Tradition Book Geothanatos Revised for Mage of the Ascension, I guess that was a heck of a thing, because my dad had passed away the previous year. And I had been, I was just devastated. And I thought I wasn't going to do any writing again. I got a job, doing tech support, face forward, take your calls, do your work, get angry at the callers, get drunk at night, go to bed. And that was going to be my life. And I also passed up some good opportunities at the time. But... I ended up, deciding to do this book. Jesse Hainig gave me the opportunity to do it. And as protagonists, I find the Thanatos, who, are these guys who decide when it's the right time for you to die, right? I found the idea reprehensible. But I also kind of enjoyed the challenge of not only dealing with protagonists I found reprehensible, but also dealing with them, I guess, as being symbolic of a personal challenge that I was having, accepting my dad's death. And I suppose, I can't say that I necessarily got any peace out of it, but I found there was a certain intellectual ordering process that came from justifying these reprehensible people who made arbitrary decisions that stood for this reprehensible process of death that seems so arbitrary, and getting something to come out of that that made it possible for me to work for it. And I think it led to some good writing. I think in that one, the process in White Wolf's Flat books, the sort of stereotypical process is that you have some viewpoint character who tells you how awesome it is to be a member of this faction, right?
And how every other faction smells.
And how every other faction smells, right? And in my work, I really kind of wanted to question that. I wanted to have viewpoint characters who didn't feel so great, your job is to, go see someone you've never met before and, put a bullet in their head, right? Yeah. And I wanted there to be doubts. I did not want it to be something where it was resolved, right? And in the end, we either learned that the character type being covered were awesome or that they were terrible people, that there was still some ambiguity. And I guess the idea is that there wasn't an easy answer in there. Was something that was comforting for me, and I think ended up being good. As for other stuff, favorite stuff I'm fond of, right now I'm working on another creator-owned game. Right? Eternal Legends, by the way, is Stu's game. He owns it. I just publish it, and I hired people to make pretty art for it. There's another game called Knights of the Hidden Sun that has been a long time coming because it is about three times the size is what I originally thought it was going to be, and it's a big, bombastic. We call it interstellar fantasy, right?
Yeah.
In that it's space opera with a fantasy base instead of a science fiction or loose science fiction base, right? And it has some great, unique ideas to it. Like one of them is that all technology is powered by souls, right? The souls of the dead, right?
Right.
And all technology is powered by the souls of the dead because, there were sort of traditional gods in the setting, but they were all killed, right?
Yeah.
But basically a hacked version of the trick they used to, to send souls to the afterlife is used to trap souls in these little objects so that they act like batteries, right? And there's a huge industry on it, and you have pirates who, kill people and put them into these crypt stones and things like that. And you have this huge far-flung interstellar society. One of the great conceits of the setting is that we call, we have, sort of cantina scene diversity in the game.
Yeah.
But the idea is that everybody's human, right? That in the distant past, you had your elves and your dwarves and your insect people and your hammerhead dudes and whatever, right?
And the wolf guy who gets cut out when George Lucas discovered CG.
Yeah. You have all those guys, right? But one of the things is that, there were all these interspecies wars, and this is back when the gods were around, so the gods decided, all right, so from now on, children will no longer resemble their parents.
Yeah.
Right? So, there's no concept of heredity in the traditional sense, right?
Right.
So, you can have all these bizarre-looking character types, right, in this sort of exotic thing without it devolving into, all these different species. This is something that I think, Chris Chalice, the creator of the game, he's a big Star Wars fan, and I think he really got the essence of something that I was thinking about, I always thought of too, which is that when you see how they try to pin down these guys who appear for 5 seconds in a bar scene,
yeah.
Right? Like Rodians,
yeah.
Right? The one guy's a bounty hunter. So they're all bounty hunters everywhere,
yeah.
Right? I mean, instead of having that, right, I thought the beauty of, the cantina scene, of a cantina scene sort of setup, right, is that you have all these people from everywhere, right? You have this sort of amplified version of the Trader's Bazaar, right?
Yeah.
Where if you have people all over the world talking to each other and having this interchange, and you don't really know what's necessarily happening in the background, and it's great and it's cool, but they're all people,
yeah.
Right? And having that device in the game allows for us to have that.
Mm-hmm.
There's also some great art coming out for it. I just wish I could work on it faster, but it's so big and there's contracts and, I also do some nonprofit work and all that gets in the way. But I'm hoping I can get a substantial chunk of it out to people to see for themselves, followed by a full release next year.
Okay. And you mentioned a couple of upcoming projects, but anything else on the horizon you want to mention?
Well, I mean, I can't really mention much beyond Imperial Mysteries. I also do some work in computer games and social networks and a few other things. But unfortunately, my role for a lot of these things is as the guy who writes the stuff you'll never see, right?
Right.
Like my last big project was for a setting bible for a squad-based MMO, right? That has yet to be released, right? And that got turned into sort of a pitch document and a guide and an artist guide and all these things. So all these internal documents and something for investors, right? And, you know, someday it's going to be turned into text that will be read on a screen, but we're not there yet. And that's the kind of work I'm also doing.
Okay.
So not much more I can talk about, but I'm hoping to be able to mention more on my blog and my site, people who follow me on Twitter and that kind of thing.
You can mention those URLs if you like.
All right. well, my blog and, I used to do a little more cheesy markety stuff. So it's sort of in the process of being changed back into something a little less soulless. But my blog / site is at mobunited.com. And I'm at twitter.com/MalcolmShepard. And I'm Mob United on Facebook if anyone wants to see the paltry public feed. Or you can say you want to add me. And I'm on Google+, too. And I'm very slutty on Google+, just because circles are so handy. So I'll probably add you back if you add me.
All right. And because this runs on a website where the week this drops, I'll be lucky if this gets half so many hits as a bunch of Final Fantasy 13 screenshots. Do you have any favorite video game RPGs you want to mention?
Oh, video game RPGs. Oh, God. See, the trouble is I suck at video games. So, I mean, I'm trying to go through the original Dragon Age, and I'm doing the Tower Assault right now, and I don't have a thief, and I'm just getting my ass kicked.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of BioShock, although I think I've had a better time looking over my stepson's shoulder while he played it than playing it myself. Aside from that, gee, I don't know. You know, I'm a real, real big fan of first and third person shooters. I always feel the role assumption is stronger there than in something where I'm fiddling about with a bunch of stats, right? I feel more immersed. So I guess you could say I'm more of a shooter guy.
Okay. apparently BioWare is hell-bent on blending RPG with every genre they can find.
Yeah, well, that's, I'm kind of interested. I do plan on giving Dragon Age 2, a try. And I think I may actually, I am looking forward to Mass Effect 2. The original Mass Effect I thought was interesting, but again, it's not exactly my cup of tea.
Right.
So yeah, if it's a little more shooty, right, I am, when it comes to manipulating numbers through a computer game, I'm a dummy and I hate it. But I can point and pull a trigger, so.
All right. Thanks a bunch for chatting with me, and thanks for listening.